Welcome. Jump into the Compassionate Leader Circle podcast, where leading with love isn't just nice, it's genius. I'm Laurel Donnellan.
And I'm Daryl Brown. We'll unpack business strategies infused with empathy and action, driving both profit and purpose. Our world is ever-changing, so discover how the savvy leader wears compassion as their power suit.
Those of you listening to this podcast with Dennis Ring are in for a big treat. He's a remarkable man, and he's got a lot of wonderful stories and wonderful wisdom. What struck you, Sarah, from the podcast that people can look forward to?
You look at the paper, the resume, the accolades of experience, and you go, oh, founder of this, CEO of this, launched this, and you might have an idea or be impressed with who this person is. But Dennis is so deeply human and comes from a place of such authenticity and humility and faith. It's just, he's the full package of human, I think. And I'll say it one more thing. It's we hear a lot about leadership models and teaching leadership and capabilities. And at the end of the day, I think Dennis has been so successful because he leads with love, respect, and he's so grounded in his values and beliefs. And that's what he's led with. This is someone who is a human and loving leader first.
And what I love about this interview that's coming up here is that he was so generous with his personal practices of faith and how he applied it to leadership. And that's a very rare thing. I think leadership, especially CEOs and founders, it can be a very lonely endeavor. And he really did everything with God and puts his relationship with God at the center of everything he does, from what I've heard and what I've seen. And I found it fascinating.
You know, Laurel gets, and this might be a whole nother podcast. I think there might be some listeners who go, faith, the faith podcast, God, I'm out. And it's really a whole nother conversation around sort of the secularization of where we are today.
But I would say to those folks, hang in there with this podcast, because whatever you believe in, you can apply to it, right? And you can substitute intuition for God.
I have a little bit of jealousy for people, someone like Dennis, who can be so rooted in faith. I've always come at some of my religious exposure in this I get stuck in a lot of dogma and go, I'm incredulous of that. And so I'm just gonna, I can't get into this. And so I back away if I'm really honest, the desire to have more faith. And so I don't know if I'm outing myself or I'm asking for coaching and therapy, Laurel. I don't know. There was something refreshing about his approach to it.
I think we're all trying to figure this out. I feel like I have had the privilege in my life of being very in religions and practicing religions, multiple religions, and being parts of multiple churches. And I've also had very agnostic chapters in my life, and it's all useful. But I understand that jealousy. I remember once going to a gospel festival in Brooklyn, and it was gospel singers, and I saw them singing and dancing and praying. And I was like, I don't have that flavor of faith. Mm. But we all start where we're at. I think this was an amazing conversation. Thank you for being a part of it. And thank you for bringing Dennis to Compassionate Leader Circle.
Well, welcome to our podcast today, Dennis. We're so happy to have you here. We have a lot of meetings, just our team. And so we always are so lucky to have leaders like yourself join us. So thank you. I'm Sarah. I'm the Chief Learning Officer at CLC. I'm an executive coach. I help us and our clients think about talent, strategy, leadership development, and individual sort of personal purpose development. Laurel is our Chief Executive Officer and founder of CLC. There's so many titles for her. I was could have gone on and on. She's a dream doula, and is very much living out her calling here, bringing compassion to the world of work and beyond. And then Dennis, I don't know where to start and stop with you. I mean, what an incredible background. A graduate of Santa Clara University, following his undergrad, he decided to join the order and did that for 7 years. He went on to Yale School of Management. He's an accomplished CEO and founder, founding the Whole Foods 365 brand, along with the founder of CEO, John Mackey. He is the central market brand launcher for HEB, and then went on to launch Ocho Chocolates in 2012, which he later sold. He currently serves on the board of Jesuit Volunteer Corp, the Center of Food Innovation and Entrepreneurship, and on the Jesuit School of Theology at Berkeley. Dennis lives in Berkeley currently with his wife, Sheila, and we are just honored to have you here today. Welcome, Dennis.
Thank you very much. I'm privileged.
So happy to spend more time with you. I was so happy to meet you recently. As we talk today, our theme, our loose theme is faith. When I started working with organizations and they found the word faith and love in my change models, they thought I was wacky. I stuck with it, and they don't think I'm so wacky anymore. But when we talk about faith with individuals who are trying to make more of their lives and careers, or organizations who are trying to connect more deeply with their people, I think about faith as a point of view and a practice. So it's a very personal thing, and I'm excited to hear more about your thoughts about faith and holiness. But when we work with folks, we try to help them think about what their point of view is and how they can connect to their own soul, whatever that means for them, and what the practice is around that. And in organizations, we shift the language a little bit to connecting to inspiration, because sometimes the word soul can trigger people. So I would love to get your overview on holiness and faith and why it's been important to you. But before we do that, I really love to hear more about your personal story, Dennis, and how you went from seminary to CEO. Maybe you can give us the how that unfolded.
You want the cliff notes on that?
Or as much as you want to share, welcome.
I grew up in California in the East Bay, and when I went to Santa Clara University as an undergrad, I began to recognize that there was a big world out there, and I decided to take my junior year and live in Europe. I went to Vienna and studied on an international program. And it was interesting for me because although my family was nominally Irish Catholic, even before all during high school and even before high school, I gravitated toward quiet in nature. And where I grew up, there were creeks and hills and beautiful land that was, you know, undeveloped. And I would often find myself, you know, up in the hills with my dog walking around just because something happened to me when I was up there. And I look back on it now and I realize that those were certainly moments of holiness, but also moments of faith development. Who am I? What makes me feel good, or what's meaningful in my life? Anyway, while I was in Europe, I went and looked at a lot of the cathedrals and different religious sites, came back to Santa Clara, which is a Jesuit-run university. And it was during that year that I asked myself the question, what's most meaningful to me? And it wasn't to be an accountant and buy a cool car. It had to do with how I connected with God in nature. And I applied to the Jesuit order and I was accepted. And during that time, the first few years as a Jesuit, you're called a novice, and you do a bunch of different things where you're exposed to different aspects of the order. And for example, I mean, I worked with homeless and undocumented people in downtown LA. I was a hospital orderly for a spell. I worked at an orphanage in Mexico for a short period of time. And then there at the end of that second year, there's an opportunity to do a much longer stint in some other apostolate. And they asked me if I'd go to Loyola High School. in Los Angeles, a boys' high school, and teach there. And I did that, and then I took my vows. Interestingly, at Loyola High, we had a good group of guys, including Greg Boyle from Homeboy Industries, Mike Barber, who's the bishop here in the Oakland Diocese, Tom Smolich, who I had dinner with last night, who, after he did his Stanford MBA, became the provincial and then oversaw all of the Jesuits in North America before being reassigned to run Jesuit refugee services in Rome. So he was all over the globe. I finished my vows. I was assigned to go to Fordham. I got a master's degree in philosophy. And during that time, because I had an undergraduate degree in business, they were saying, well, what do you think? And I was interested in business ethics. So I told the people who were in charge of me, I was interested in business ethics. They said, well, why don't you go get a good MBA? And I ended up at Yale doing a master's in business there. I was assigned to teach at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles. And during that year, after a lot of discernment and heartache, I decided that it would be better for me not to stay in the order. And I left. And that put me out into the real world. I hated the real world. It's really hard. I missed the Jesuits a lot. I started out in strategy for telecommunications. Okay, this is where it gets a little bit, you know, Laurel, I appreciate how you're sensitive about using terminology like faith, but I knew I wanted to do something in food. Okay. And I wanted to do something in food because the most meaningful and memorable experiences I've had in my life have been at the table with people I care about having a good meal. And in the Jesuits, this was very common to celebrate for feast days. And even when I was in business school, you know, I was with a group of people who liked to cook. And I got into food. I started working originally. Well, I mean, I was in telecommunication strategy, which was, I mean, it was killing me. It was so meaningless and so artificial in terms of who I felt I was as a person. But look, I just left the order. I didn't have a car. I didn't have a bed. I just took the first job I could get. So I did that. Hated it. Knew I hated it. Got into food. Worked as a buyer at Grocery Outlet, the chain here in California. Was recruited to go in to work at the Costco buying office to work with the buying team as an outside company. And it was during that time where I was helping. I had done some private label development for Costco. I had also been in touch with some people at Whole Foods. This led to an appointment, a meeting with John Mackey, who was the CEO. I brought in another guy who had worked with me at Grocery Outlet. He was a former Trader Joe's employee. And we had both worked a little bit with Joe Colomb, Trader Joe. But I said, you need an affordable private label. And I'm really skipping over a lot of juicy stuff.
We're going to come back and ask you questions, Dennis.
Yeah, okay.
This is a really good story, though. It's so good.
We start doing this program for Whole Foods, and I had ownership in the brand, the 365 brand, and John bought out that ownership after 5 years. I stayed around for another year, left, started my own company, and immediately HEB called up, and they said, hey, can y'all do for us what you did for Whole Foods? And I said, yeah. So I did some stuff, not for some HEB, but mostly for Central Market. They're sort of subsidiary of high-end stores. While I was doing that, various companies from around the country were asking my little company to work with them, including one in South Africa. And then ultimately, I knew the fellow who was the VP of private label or store brands at Safeway. And he and I, we were friends. This is important. He's a very devout Christian man, not Catholic, but he had left working for a company called Ahold. He left his family in Virginia. So every few weeks I would say, let's go out to dinner. And I promised myself not to talk about business because I felt that he needed interaction with somebody who knew he knew and we were friends. And he wasn't being treated as a means to an end. He didn't have to portray himself as a business executive. We were just pals. And one night we were at a Mexican restaurant and he drew an O and wrote the word organic underneath it. He says, do you think you can get me 150 SKUs in 10 months? I said, that's a land speed record, but I can do it. And we did. And that led to the O Organic program there. After a certain period of time, I began to, and I, you know, we had, I was leading teams at both Whole Foods and at Safeway and the rest of the company. But I'd spent my career making everybody else's brand successful. So I wanted to start this company called Ocho, which is really where that was the nexus of where I had the authority as a CEO to implement programs that were much more, I'll use this term, let's just call it, I mean, it's not faith-based, but we had an opportunity to do things without referring to our faith that exhibited the values of the faith. And I can come back and talk a little bit about that.
There's so many things I want to dig into from through the lens of faith. I'd like to go back and hear a little bit more about your journey from priesthood to civilianhood. And you talked about discernment, a lot of discernment, which is an important word for me. It's actually a word that we use in our coaching model. So I'd love to hear from you, like, what does discernment mean and what was that like for you?
That's a really good question. And I could talk for 7 hours on this, but I'm not. I'm trying to do it for,
yeah. Well, we might have to do a series with you, Darryl. This is the first one.
In the Jesuit tradition, discernment is an essential characteristic of our faith. And it has to, and Ignatius, when he founded the order, had certain guidelines for how discernment takes place and how to evaluate what's happening in your heart during discernment. And it took me a year. And my spiritual director at the time recommended to me a phrase as a guide, you know, as a guiding light that I have used ever since. He said, "Dennis, choose to do that which is most life-giving."
Mm.
And this led to conversations. His point was, it may be that what's most life-giving for you isn't ordained priesthood. It may be that what's most life-giving for you may include getting married, having kids, a career, a creative professional career. That was the light that sort of held me in a very dark place. I hated leaving the Jesuits. I mean, and I'm still very close. I mean, like, I had dinner with like one of my guys I met, you know, 4 years ago. And my best friend is now the university chaplain at Santa Clara University. And he and I are going to go for a hike in a couple of weeks and have dinner. But I love the order. It wasn't right for me. It works beautifully for some people, but I hated leaving the order. And so I didn't. In fact, I sometimes think of myself as a lay Jesuit because I am trying to carry out the faith and spiritual practices of which I picked up in my own Jesuit formation.
Well, I know enough about Jesuits that they are very serious about service and giving back. And I think from what I know about you, it sounds like you've blended your civilian life and your Jesuit life through business decisions. So I'd also like to go back to the original mission and vision for 365. And for those listeners that don't know what that is, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that. And I live in Austin, so I've been going to Whole Foods since they started to the flagship property, and I have a 365 near me. So, and food is also near and dear to my heart. So there's a lot of connection.
Well, the premise for 365 at Whole Foods was to create a more affordable line of products. It wasn't faith-based. For me, I drew energy from the creativity because in the end, what I told John wouldn't work for his company. This irritated him. I mean, we were in a meeting for 15 minutes and I said, "I won't work for you." And he's you know, curious as to why. And at the time, Whole Foods had this consensus decision-making model, which I call the Kumbaya model, where you sit around and you talk about how you feel. You can't make a decision. And I said, "John, I can't take that. I don't have the strength to endure that." He came back a month later and said, "I'm going to put you and the guy that I had with me, Bob, you're in charge of everything." And this was what's really exciting to me because it created it afforded me an opportunity to be super creative in terms of product selection, And then he said, you're in charge of designing all of the packaging. You choose the product, you choose the vendor, you choose the price point, which really upset people at Whole Foods because I was keeping a lower profit margin per item in order to make friends. I kept saying we're making friends. But also, I mean, and this opened the door to, okay, so we were in charge of everything. And John said, if you succeed, I'm going to buy you out in 5 years, you'll make some money. If you fail, he created a separate subsidiary. You're not technically an employee of Whole Foods. So if you fail, it was like Mission Impossible. Like, I will disavow any knowledge of your existence. And it took off. It was here. But the point was, for me, that wasn't ministry. That was creativity. And it was people at table. And what ended up following from that were deeply nourishing relationships with my vendor community and some other people in the company. There are some people who really got it, but I mean, it's very common in those days, and I still think it's true, that in the organic food space, people appreciate being at table. So that was the genesis of 365. It's different now, and it's committee run, and it's all based on margin. But for a bright shining moment, it was an exquisite experience, and I would run around the globe. I went to all of my vendors, whether it was Austin or Seattle or Italy, and I would say I have the best job in the world.
Beautiful. Yeah, I was wondering if it's shifted back to, so it's now part of the Amazon universe. So it's a little different culturally. I'm still a customer because I believe in the original mission and I connect to that. So,
well, you know, one of the heartening things that happened. So 365, the products that John said, you have to have a certain profit contribution for every item, or on average. And I was always north of that, significantly north, sometimes 15 to 20% north of the target. But one day, and people were angry because 365, we did a half liter of Italian olive oil at $6.99. The only other option for half a liter at the time was $9.99. And so all the regional buyers get their bonus based on dollars per category and a profit contribution. They were mad at me. Like, you're trading people down. One of the employees down in North Carolina said, you know what? Thanks to 365, my family, which isn't rich, can afford to go to Whole Foods. I love that he took the time to tell me that.
So one other question about your journey. What was it like to finally have your own brand, and why did you choose chocolate?
Oh, very good. Again, I love these questions. It's not because I was sitting around at home making candy bars. But when I was at Whole Foods, it was early on in the trajectory, in the arc of organic food product development. And every time they took those seven letters of organic and put it on something, people noticed. And where I live, there's a restaurant here in Berkeley called Chez Panisse. And Alice lives around the corner, but I would go and look at the menu. This is a sort of a long intro, but it'll make sense. I'd look at the menu and she would say, for example, oh, we're going to have a peach galette on Saturday night with organic peaches from Frog Hollow Farms. I'm thinking, and then there were other things that were organic. And then it began to click for me. For me, it wasn't about sustainability. It was always about stewardship, right? How do we make sure that the earth, that we don't wash all of our topsoil down in Mississippi? Anyway, I was watching all these brands take off, and I thought someday somebody's going to make an organic Snickers. And I called the woman who was making nutrition bars. I had a version, well, I'll leave the brand names out, but I was making nutrition and granola type bars. She had worked at Mars and she knew Forest Mars. And I said, hey, can you make an organic Snickers? She goes, oh yeah. So we started doing bench tops. And then I shared those bench tops. My kids went to the local Catholic school. I started sharing them with everybody. She'd make 100 of them. I'd start handing them out. And people were saying, like, wow, damn, these are good. And one of the guys became my partner at Ocho, Scott Kucharek. He had been in real estate, but he wanted to get out. And I said, like, I'm going to need a good CEO. So the reason Ocho, which O is for organic, Cho is for chocolate, the reason Ocho got started was because I thought there would be an opportunity, a marketing and product opportunity, and a void in the marketplace. So that's how it got started. And I loved it. I loved having, you know, my own brand and designing the logo and everything like that.
It was really a business decision to choose chocolate.
Yes. Yes, exactly. I mean, I have a sweet tooth, admittedly. Even during Lent, I have a hard sweet tooth. But I knew all of these bar makers, and I knew, but I had gone to Switzerland to get an organic 365 chocolate bar. And I knew a bunch of people globally who could help me with this. And I just thought it would be exciting to do it, to do a brand. And I still consult with a lot of people who have emerging brands.
Sarah, do you have any questions for Dennis around his past and his journey so far?
You know, Laura, I'll always have a question, and forgive me if we'll get to this, but Dennis, I met you at the Why Kind Leaders Win event in Berkeley, put on by our friends at the Greater Good Science Center.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if or how your faith, your experience in the order, how did that translate into your leadership? And if that was, you know, conscious or unconscious?
I have some responses to that, but I'm going to focus it mostly on Ocho, but also the previous experiences. You know, look, when we were at Ocho, we started very small. We had 5 students who had just graduated from the undergraduate degree program at UC Davis. And we thought, well, these guys would be good to hire. It's like they knew each other. And we called them Oompa Loompas. So we started working with our 5 Oompa Loompas. We were doing one shift a day. I'm going to come back to you, but this is the bit, but we did one shift a day, 5 days a week. A year later, we were doing 3 shifts a day, 24/7, 55 employees, 5 days, six days a week. As we were growing, we were hiring people. And it was clear that some of the people who wanted to work for us and were people who lived in our neighborhood who could walk or ride a bike to work. We were in West Oakland, which is an economically very depressed area. It's very dangerous. There's no opportunity. If you want to talk about a food desert, this place is the Sahara. There is no place where you can buy food. And what became clear was that these were people who wanted to work, but who couldn't, who never had the opportunity to really get a job that they, you know, that they could hold. So we would hire people. And that included hiring formerly incarcerated people from a halfway house that was in the neighborhood. We did that repeatedly. And I can come back to that. But to go to the question, Sarah, in the meantime, now I've been tracking Greg Boyle over at Homeboy Industries and reading his books. And I've been in touch with him talking about sort of this radical kinship and kindness. And the way I looked at myself in the world was that I won the birth lottery. I was born a white male in America in the 50s, and I'm well educated, and there were opportunities that I didn't even have to seek out that presented themselves to me because of those experiences. And one of the guiding lights in my life then became, well, I have no dignity as a man unless I help create circumstances where people who didn't win the birth lottery at least get a chance to participate in the upside of life, right? I can tell you some stories about that. But in Ignatian spirituality and in Catholic social teaching, there is a theme of reaching out to those in need, to be compassionate, to be respectful, and to be celebratory in these relationships. I remember I was in high school and first part of college, I had a summer job. It was manual labor, literally like digging ditches. And they wouldn't refer to me by a name. They wouldn't say, hey, Dennis, can you go to the truck and get this tool? It was, "Hey, summer help." And I had been degraded into, they didn't bother to speak my name. And I remember that because the anonymity, and it wasn't maybe degradation intentionally, but it was, I wasn't worthy enough to be called by my name. And I carried that forward the rest of my life to make sure that whoever I was working with, I would take time to create a personal relationship with. So we had people from Mexico, Central America, Myanmar, Ethiopia, Thailand, the hood. And I would never go out and talk about my faith. They knew that our leadership team, and Scott, my partner, you know, I met him at the, as he was a parent at the local Catholic school. There was never conflict with my, there was a little, there's never serious conflict with the leadership team, because I was willing to give more than was expected. I would pray about this, and I didn't want to say, "Oh, I want you all to be Catholic," or "I want you all to be Christian." It was, "I'm treating you all with respect and dignity because I'm fond of you for who you are." Let me give you two examples where my faith was activated, as I just described. One was with a woman who had worked for us, and she got her daughter to come work for us. They lived in West Oakland, rough. One day she said, "Hey, Mr. Dennis, when I put my hand on the wall of our apartment, I feel heat from the wires." She says, "We're afraid." I said, "Should be. Do you know anybody, you know anybody who has an apartment?" So I called around some friends. I didn't get an apartment, but I would check in with her every few weeks. She worked for us. Her daughter worked for us. Her son worked for us during the summers and worked side by side with my son. And they, you know, they live in economically stressed circumstances in Oakland. So when I saw her, when she goes, "Hey, we found a place." I said, "Oh, great. When are you moving in?" She goes, "This weekend." I said, "Cool." So I had gone on a business trip. I came back Tuesday. I said, "How's the new place?" But for her and her daughter, she said, "Well, we didn't get it." I said, "What happened? Somebody get it?" She goes, "No, they raised the security deposit from $1,000 to $3,000 because we're Section 8, which is the subsidized housing in California." So I'm looking at her, and I mean, you can imagine what's going through my mind. This is a woman whose two kids worked for the company, who were, my son knew, her family. And I said, "Well, is it still available?" She goes, "Yeah." I said, "At the next break, go call the landlord and tell him you have the money." She goes, "What do you mean?" I said, "I'll bring a check tomorrow, $2,000. And so the waterworks started, and her daughter was there, and they were, she goes, "Well, you know," I said, "just like, let's not talk about it. I'll give you the money." And I had to write out the check. I said, "Do you use check cashing services here in the neighborhood?" Because they take a certain percent, like sometimes 20%. She goes, "Yeah." I said, "Well, does anybody in your family not, does anybody have an account?" She goes, "Yeah, my son." So I wrote out the check to him, gave it to her, and they got the spot, they got the place. And I never raised it, that question again. And I figured at some point she would come and say, "Well, how do we pay you back?" And she did do that. I mean, she recognized that an act of generosity had taken place. And she said, I could start paying you back monthly. I said, no. As long as you're working here, or as long as you're in the apartment, let's just not worry about it. I didn't want, you know, the way I look at it is, if I were her and someone had been generous to me, I would want to repay, but I also didn't want her to feel indebted or constrained, or I didn't want to degrade her dignity as a woman by saying, "Oh, okay, well, you can start paying me back." There's another episode, and this was me saying, in my life, I have been privileged, and blessed are the poor. Okay. I can't solve all of her problems, but I had an opportunity. You know, there's a guy named Jim Keenan, who is a theologian at Boston College, a Jesuit. And I read his book last summer. It's called A History of Catholic Social Ethics. And his tagline, he has two really cool taglines. One is, "Sin is the failure to bother to love." The other one is love is a willingness to enter into another person's chaos. So I entered into her chaos, and I made sure that it wasn't a failure to bother to love. An opportunity presented, and I felt I had no other recourse. So, but then some time later, a few years later, a guy came in one day to interview for a job, older man, 45, maybe 40. And we hired him. He was great. It was lovely to be there. I really enjoyed the guy because he was cross-cultural. He got along with all of the different racial groups in the organization, showed up, didn't gossip, was joyful. One day he didn't come in on a Monday. He's gone. I didn't know until he disappeared that he was formerly incarcerated. Okay. And he was gone. And so we were trying to call his mom. I knew he was living with his mom, but he had a relapse. I think he had a drug binge on a weekend, and he was gone. Nobody knew where he was. A few months later, 5 o'clock, 5:30 in the afternoon, I get this phone call from an attorney. She announces who she is. She says, "I'm representing a former employee of yours," which is like, oh God, no. There's like somebody's cooked up a fake lawsuit, right? And she said that his name, and I said, "Where is he?" And she says, "He's incarcerated." I said, "Is he at Santa Rita?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Can I see him? I want to go visit him." She said, "Funny thing, that's why we're on the phone. He was going to be appear before the judge tomorrow for a hearing." And she had said to him, she had asked him, "Is there anybody you know who can write a letter for you on behalf of your conduct and present it to the judge?" And the opening line is, as soon as he is out of jail, he has a job in our company, no questions asked. The guy needed a chance. I mean, everybody makes mistakes, and everybody makes these same mistakes repeatedly, right? But and so I wrote this letter, and I asked, and I sent it over. I said, like, "Oh, in 10 minutes after this phone call, you'll have a letter in your inbox." But what I wanted was to go to the courtroom, and I said, all he needs is to look me in the eye. If I look him in the eye, he will know everything about what's going on. And she said, "Yeah, you know, it's going to be hard. It could be at 8 in the morning. It could be at 4 in the afternoon. I didn't get to see him, but he did get released. He came back, and then he moved. He had to go through the system. He had to move up to a different county for a 12-step program. But look, this isn't about me being me seeking attention. This is about a person who has an opportunity, who encounters a holy moment and responds in a way that endeavors to promote, respect the dignity of another person.
Well, I appreciate these stories so much, Dennis. And I think our listeners will appreciate them because we all have faith of some sort. We may not all have religion, but we have faith in belief in something. And I think sometimes we're so inundated with rules and policies and HR handbooks that we forget to act from that faith. And both of your stories really demonstrate being compassionate in a way that may be a little strange to some people, but authentic, you know. And I think we have to put the rule book aside and go into our hearts a little deeper to make better decisions as leadership, as a society. So they're beautiful stories and we appreciate them so much. So now that you are no longer a CEO, what are you doing now? And I'm curious about what your personal faith practices are and what you're up to professionally or as a mentor, or whatever you're doing in this phase of your life.
I think a lot about holiness and how we define it, how we encounter it. For me, I like this term holiness, and I've been writing a little bit about it. I've given some presentations on it, that holiness occurs when we our hearts and minds are moved beyond what's happening in the moment. Okay. something happens. We may not recognize it until we look back on it at the end of the day and say, wait a minute, I had this encounter with a colleague that was really quite lovely, but I was rushing off to the next meeting or whatever it may be. But holiness happens. So I'm looking at this and I think, wouldn't it be nice if I paid more attention to holiness, trying to explain what I think it is, because I think it floats above all the world religions and all of the world practices, Islam, Hindu, Buddhism, all, yeah, Buddhism, holiness, but not a monotheistic God, and Christianity. In all of human history, there have been practices where people do things to try and experience something that could be defined as holy. And I'm less concerned about what brand of holiness this is, and more concerned about the fact that there's something that, if we're paying attention, is happening in our lives and can open the door to reflection and prayer or some connection to a loving creator. I love the 12-step language, because like you know, Laurel, you were saying that you used this terminology faith. And I have written some stuff, and I'm in touch with some social scientists who say, if you use God, if you even use the word God or faith, you're going to lose everybody, you know, all of the, you know, everybody under the age of 40. I disagree with that. But I think that we all have access to moments of holiness in our lives, and it's a good practice to reflect on it. What I'm doing, though, I've helped start a myth. I'm really concerned. This is going to sound really bad. I got to make sure I don't misstate this. I grew up, when I was 25, I lived in a community of men who were 50 and 75 and everything in between. And we would sit around at dinner and they would just, you know, we were loyal, loving friends. There's lots of joy and razzing and challenging and support. I mean, I was loved by people who cared about me, men who cared about me. And I look at young men today and I see this in every aspect of our culture. One of the most beautiful things I had at the age of 25 and 30 was an access to other guys who were older than me and loving relationships. So I have a men's group at our local parish with some other guys, and we get together and we have these dinners. Some of us go to Costco, we buy tri-tip and coffee. They don't have to pay. And there's beer or wine or mixed drinks, and they show up and we all know who we are and we socialize. It's usually, we announce it, it's usually roughly 40 guys who show up, all ages. And it's a form of socializing, because I think with screens and post-COVID, it's harder and harder, not just for men, but for everybody in our society to connect. So there's one question. We sit around in tables, and it's like the way the synod was conducted in Rome. And the question is like, the last three questions, one of them was, how do you grieve? What do you do for prayer? And the last one a few weeks ago was, where do you encounter the most joy in your life today? And the guys go around the table and they talk about it. I also am doing some work over at the Catholic Newman Center here at Cal. And I have done some stuff with the younger people in our parish. I want to get them to come together. They're doing their confirmation class. I could never figure out why we have confirmation, but they're doing it. They have to suffer through it. I've talked to them twice, and I'm trying to figure out whether we could have like a special, you know, musical evening for them. Or I like the idea, because I'm in the food space, like, well, I'll invite 20 or 30 people over to the kitchen. We'll just cook something up. It might be Italian night. We'll make spaghetti. We'll do something, somebody, you know, and just have that process of making a meal and then sharing it afterwards. Also, I have a pizza oven in my backyard, so I invite a lot of people over for, this goes back to our homegirl story. I'm blabbering, I know, but I mean, I'm cognizant that we might have to be respectful of the time here. I can tell you what we did on Friday
we'd love to hear it. And I think where we're getting to is hope for the future and
yes.
how you can impact younger people. And
yes. 100%. So I don't know if everybody knows about Homeboy Industries, but it's a gang intervention and reentry program in LA started by a guy named Greg Boyle, and it's deeply impactful for a lot of people. So Greg said, oh, by the way, one of the women who had gone through the program was going to be up at getting a law degree at Cal. It's like, what? And he said, yeah, she's like really incredible. She was in and out of foster homes and other issues. She, you know, left Homeboy, came back, left, came back, got, you know, had her tattoos removed, went to junior college, got into UCLA, and then got into Cal Law. I couldn't get into, I got into Yale. I couldn't get into Cal Law, but anyhow, she's there. And I tried to reach, I tried to connect with her last year, but she didn't. But on last Friday, we finally connected. And my whole goal was to make sure she had a friend in Berkeley. That's all I wanted. I mean, she's from gangland, Los Angeles, South Central, right? I'm not, maybe she's from a different neighborhood, but I just thought, wouldn't it be nice if she had a friend in Berkeley? So we had coffee and she was telling me about her life and her 9-year-old daughter, and smart, compassionate, joyful, honest, unashamed. And I was so taken. I said, listen, why don't you and your daughter come over to my house on Sunday? And every Sunday night, my daughter and her husband and their baby come over. I always have people over on Sunday night. It takes a long time to fire up the pizza oven. It's a wood-fired pizza. So it takes a few hours. I always make the dough. Everybody gets to make their pizza. So I said, why don't you and your daughter come over? She goes, oh, right. And I sent her some pictures of other kids who'd come over to the house making their pizza. So she thought that was kind of cute and fun. So they came over, and we were all just amazed at how comfortable she was and how open she was about her own personal history. You know, Greg Boyle is pretty successful in LA, and he goes to these fundraisers and stuff. And I think she's been to a few of them, but it's not the kind of experience that she gets very often where she, you know, somebody says, bring your daughter over and we'll make pizza. And it was kinship. That's what it was. Cool.
Our time today is coming to a close, but I've loved the conversation. Sarah has a couple of more questions for you, and then we'll wrap for now. And then Sarah and I will be making an appointment to come over for pizza.
It's all academic research, right?
Yeah, precisely. So we like to wrap our conversations with two questions, which is, Dennis, what leadership lesson, one leadership lesson would you share with our listeners? And then what life lesson would you share with our listeners?
The leadership one would revolve around recognition of, or the importance of humility and recognition of luck. A lot of people who are in senior management, I mean, the people I've met who have emotional intelligence will say, you know, I got lucky. Or, you know, everybody says, oh, I work really hard. I hate hearing that. The guy, you know, anyway, so humility that you don't have as a leader. You never have all the answers. You need other people. You're going to have feelings. You know, before we did the Greater Good Science Center, I was talking with Kia. And I said, like, how many of these CEOs go home at the end of a hard day and weep and cry into the arms of their partner? It happens all the time. It's overwhelming. But humility and a willingness to receive feedback, honestly, a practice, though, I would say is like, give yourself, I would love to see more people in senior management, CEOs, or others, just to stop from time to time and consider how people who work in their organization actually live their lives, depending on the person. And I do some stuff around this, but why don't you just ask God or your creator? This is the 12th step, you know, God, as you know, got a higher power to be with you in peace and to sustain you. And allow your brain and your soul the quiet moment from time to time to just say, wow, I'm so privileged and I've been lucky. And therefore I need to move into the world with love and compassion and humility. The life lesson would be allow love to operate. Michael Pollan, the writer, also did a book on LSD and hallucinogens. He was researching it. And when asked what his great, he was on an LSD trip, which I would never take. It scares me. And he was being interviewed, and the interviewer said, well, what was the great universal insight that you got? And he said, it's all about love. And it is, however we can encounter it.
That's a beautiful ending to a beautiful conversation. Thank you for your time, Dennis. And we look forward to continuing the conversation and eating pizza with you at some point.
What's your favorite topping?
Arugula, olive oil, yes. Garlic.
I grow arugula in my backyard. Arugula is a hit. Sarah, what's your favorite topping?
Well, all vegetables. So green family arugula, throw it on.
And backyard tomatoes.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
And that's a heart-wrapped episode of the Compassionate Leader Circle podcast. May your compass always point to kindness.
As you navigate the world, let compassion be your North Star. Join us next time as we continue to redefine success one heart-led decision at a time.
Lead wisely, lead with heart. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com.